This episode of the OrthoBullets podcast will go over the topic of pediatric spondylolisthesis and spondylolysis from the spine section on orthobullets.com. Spondylolisthesis and spondylolysis are common causes of low back pain in children and adolescents. These conditions represent a continuum of disease, including a pars stress reaction, spondylolysis, and spondylolisthesis. Now, let's go over some of these definitions. A pars stress reaction is sclerosis with incomplete bone disruption of the pars. Spondylolysis is a term used to describe an anatomic defect or a radiolucent gap in the pars interarticularis with adjacent bone sclerosis. With respect to the epidemiology of spondylolysis, this is one of the most common causes of back pain in children and adolescents. Defects are not present at birth and develop over time, and is seen in 4-6% of the population. As far as the mechanism of spondylolysis, it's usually activity-related and occurs from repetitive hyperextension. The prevalence is as high as 47% in certain athletes, for example gymnasts, weightlifters, and football linemen. Spondylolisthesis is defined as forward translation of one vertebral segment over the one beneath it. With respect to the epidemiology of spondylolisthesis, approximately 15% of individuals with a pars interarticularis lesion have progression to spondylolisthesis. The most common location of spondylolisthesis is at L5-S1, which make up 90% of spondylolisthesis in adolescents and adults. As far as risks of progression of spondylolisthesis, the larger the slip, the more likely it is to progress. Dysplastic slips or Wiltse type 1 lesions are more likely to progress. With respect to the severity of the current slip, this correlates most strongly with pelvic incidence. Now, let's go over some spondylolisthesis classification systems, and the ones to know are the Wiltse-Newman classification, the Marchetti-Bartolozzi classification, and the Meyerding classification. The Wiltse-Newman classification is divided into 5 types. Type 1 is described as dysplastic and secondary to congenital abnormalities of lumbosacral articulation, including mal-oriented or hypoplastic facets, sacral deficiency, and a poorly developed pars. In a Wiltse-Newman type 1 spondylolisthesis, the posterior elements are intact, and there is no spondylolysis. Keep in mind that type 1 injuries tend to have more significant neurologic symptoms. Type 2 is divided into 3 subtypes: type 2A, type 2B, and type 2C. Type 2A is an isthmic pars fatigue fracture. Type 2B is an isthmic pars elongation due to a healed stress fracture. And type 2C is an isthmic pars acute fracture. Type 3 is characterized as a degenerative spondylolisthesis. Type 4 is a traumatic spondylolisthesis. And type 5 is a neoplastic spondylolisthesis. Moving on to the Marchetti-Bartolozzi classification, the 2 types are developmental and acquired. Developmental includes Wiltse types 1 and 2. The acquired type is characterized as traumatic, post-surgical, pathologic, or degenerative changes. Acquired is characterized as traumatic, post-surgical, pathologic, or degenerative. The Meyerding classification is characterized into 5 grades. Grade 1 is characterized as less than 25% slip. Grade 2 is 25-50%, grade 3 is 50-75%, grade 4 is 75-100%, and grade 5 is spondyloptosis. With respect to the presentation of patients with spondylolisthesis and spondylolysis, keep in mind that most cases of spondylolysis are asymptomatic. However, symptoms can include insidious onset of activity-related low back pain and/or buttock pain. Neurologic symptoms include hamstring tightness, which is the most common, as well as knee contracture. Other neurologic symptoms include radicular pain, usually from the L5 nerve root, bowel and bladder symptoms, and finally, keep in mind that symptoms of Cauda-Aquina syndrome are rare. In the setting of a listhetic crisis, there is severe back pain aggravated by extension and relieved by rest. This condition is also associated with a neurologic deficit, as well as hamstring spasm, in which the patient will walk with a crouched gait. On physical exam, with respect to palpation and motion, you may notice that the patient has a flattened lumbar lordosis, has a palpable step-off of the spinous process. They may have limitation of lumbar flexion and extension, where specifically they will have pain with single-limb standing lumbar extension, And finally, make sure to measure the popliteal angle to evaluate for hamstring tightness. On neurologic exam, straight leg raise may be positive, and a rectal exam should be conducted if bowel and bladder symptoms are present. Now let's talk about some relevant imaging in the setting of a pars stress reaction and spondylolysis. With radiographs on a lateral view, these may show a defect in the pars in 80% of cases. Oblique views may show sclerosis and elongation in the pars interarticularis, otherwise known as the Scotty dog sign, and an AP view may see sclerosis of the stress reaction. Bone scans are the most sensitive, however the lesion may be cold. A bone scan is an excellent screening tool for low back pain in children or adolescents. A CT scan is the best study to diagnose and delineate the anatomy of the lesion. Keep in mind that a pars stress reaction will show up as sclerosis on x-rays and a CT scan. A single photon emission computer tomography or a SPECT scan combines the technique of a bone scan with a CT in order to help localize an area of abnormal activity seen on a bone scan. This was previously considered the best diagnostic adjunct when plain radiographs are negative, however now they are rarely performed given the unnecessary radiation exposure. Recent studies have shown MRI to be as sensitive and specific as a SPECT scan with the additional benefit of avoiding radiation exposure. Recommended views on radiographs include a lateral X-ray, which is used to measure the slip angle and grade, as well as flexion and extension radiographs used to evaluate instability. Some measurements to be aware of include the slip grade, slip angles, pelvic incidence, pelvic tilt, and sacral slope. The slip grade is defined as slippage on the plain lateral radiographic imaging measured in accordance to the vertebra below. The caudal vertebra is divided into four parts. Grade 1 means a translation of the cranial vertebra of up to 25%, grade 2 of up to 50%, grade 3 of up to 75%, grade 4 up to 100%, and grade 5 describes the ptosis of the cranial vertebra. Pelvic incidence is defined as pelvic tilt plus the sacral slope, and this is measured after a line is drawn from the center of the S1 end plate to the center of the femoral head, and then a second line is drawn perpendicular to a line drawn along the S1 end plate, intersecting the point in the center of the S1 end plate. The angle between these two lines is the pelvic incidence. This correlates with the severity of the disease, and pelvic incidence has direct correlation with the Meyerding-Newman classification. Pelvic tilt is defined as pelvic incidence minus the sacral slope. For pelvic tilt, a line is drawn from the center of the S1 end plate to the center of the femoral head, and a second vertical line that is parallel with the side margin of the radiograph is drawn intersecting the center of the femoral head. The angle between these two lines is the pelvic tilt. The sacral slope is defined as pelvic incidence minus pelvic tilt. To measure the sacral slope, a line is drawn parallel to the S1 end plate, and a second horizontal line that is parallel to the inferior margin of the radiograph is drawn, and the angle between these two lines is known as the sacral slope. As far as the CT in the setting of a spondylolisthesis, keep in mind that this is the best study to diagnose and delineate the anatomy of a pars defect. An MRI is indicated if there are neurologic symptoms present, and it can be useful to diagnose associated central and foraminal stenosis. Treatment of spondylolisthesis or spondylolysis can be non-operative or operative. Non-operative management can include observation with no activity limitations, physical therapy and activity restriction, or TLSO bracing for 6 to 12 weeks. Observation with no activity limitations is indicated for asymptomatic patients with low-grade spondylolisthesis or spondylolysis. Remember that these patients may participate in contact sports. Physical therapy and activity restriction is indicated in symptomatic ischemic spondylolysis and for symptomatic low-grade spondylolisthesis. Physical therapy should be done for 6 months and include hamstring stretching, pelvic tilts, as well as abdominal strengthening. Make sure to watch low-grade dysplastic lesions carefully as there is a higher chance of progression in these patients. TLSO bracing for 6 to 12 weeks is indicated for acute pars stress reaction spondylolysis. It's also indicated for ischemic spondylolysis that has failed to improve with physical therapy, as well as low-grade spondylolisthesis that has failed to improve with physical therapy. With respect to outcomes, brace immobilization is superior to activity restriction alone for acute stress reaction spondylolysis. Operative options may include pars interarticularis repair, L5-S1 in situ posterolateral fusion with bone grafting, or L4 to S1 posterolateral fusion plus or minus reduction plus or minus an ALIF. A pars interarticularis repair is indicated when there is an L1 to L4 isthmic defect that has failed non-operative management, as well as in the setting of multiple pars defects. This option is also indicated for a low-grade spondylolisthesis that is admired in grade 1 and 2 that has failed non-operative treatment, is progressive, has neurologic deficits, and is dysplastic due to the high propensity for progression. An L4 to S1 posterolateral fusion, plus or minus reduction, plus or minus an ALIF, is indicated for a high-grade isthmic spondylolisthesis that is admired in grade 3, 4, and 5, and keep in mind that reduction is extremely controversial with no accepted guidelines. Now, let's go over some surgical techniques in a bit more detail. With respect to a pars interarticularis repair, the approach is a posterior midline approach to the lumbar spine. With respect to the technique, you'll repair the pars defect with screw fixation, tension wiring, or screw and sublaminar hook techniques. A decompression is indicated if there are clinical symptoms of stenosis. With respect to an L5-S1 in situ posterolateral fusion with bone grafting, the approach is also a posterior midline approach to the lumbar spine. This option will involve a reduction, and with respect to the technique, it will involve an in situ fusion with bone grafting with or without instrumentation. These patients should be provided with postoperative immobilization in a TLSO, and remember that decompression is only indicated if there are clinical symptoms of stenosis or radiculopathy. An L4-S1 posterolateral fusion plus or minus reduction, with respect to an L4 to S1 posterolateral fusion plus or minus reduction, as far as the approach, this will also be done with a posterior midline approach to the lumbar spine. With respect to reduction, reduction may be done with instrumentation or positioning. As far as the pros of reduction, it can restore the sagittal alignment and reduce the lumbosacral kyphosis. However, as far as the cons, there is a risk of significant complications that is 8 to 30%, including an L5 nerve root injury, which is the most common nerve root injury with reduction. Other complications may include sexual dysfunction or catastrophic neurologic injury. Keep in mind that fusion in this option will usually be instrumented. Complications to be aware of include neurologic deficits, pseudoarthrosis, progression of slippage, and hardware failure. Okay, so now that we've gone over the major points about this topic, let's go over a few questions to apply the information and get a sense of how this topic has been tested on past exams. The first question reads, a 17-year-old male American football lineman presents with low back pain of insidious onset that is somewhat worse with activity. He has no neurologic complaints, night pain, or fevers. His symptoms have been present for a few years, but this is the first time he has sought medical attention. What physical examination finding is most likely to be found in this clinical scenario? And the choices are 1, popliteal angle of 5 degrees, 2, heel cord tightness, 3, increased femoral antiversion, 4, pain with lumbar extension in a single leg stance, and 5, numbness of the skin of the anterolateral calf and dorsum of the foot. The correct answer to this question is 4, pain with lumbar extension in a single leg stance. So the patient demographics and clinical presentation are consistent with lumbar spondylolysis. Pain with lumbar extension is the most common physical exam finding. Office assessment of the patient with spondylolysis should note pertinent negatives that would signify other causes of back pain. The history is most commonly negative for neurologic symptoms such as weakness or numbness, although patients will occasionally have radicular pain. On exam, patients may have localized spasm or tenderness, step off if there is spondylolisthesis, or hamstring tightness. The most common finding is pain with lumbar extension. McCleary et al. Review the diagnosis and treatment of spondylolysis in athletes. They identified 3 types of patients with spondylolysis. 1, a female dancer or gymnast who is hyperlordotic with increased motion and flexibility. 2, a male weightlifter or football player undergoing a growth spurt with decreased motion and flexibility, especially of the spinal erectors. And 3, a novice athlete undergoing vigorous preparation for a new sport with poor core strength and flexibility. Moving on to the next question. A 12-year-old gymnast has had progressive low back and buttock pain refractory to conservative management for 2 years. A sagittal MRI shows a high-grade L5-S1 spondylolisthesis. Surgical management with reduction of L5 on S1 would most likely lead to which of the following neurologic complications? And the choices are 1. Decreased patellar reflexes, 2. Weakness to hip flexion, 3. Weakness to great toe extension, 4. Weakness to knee extension, and 5. Weakness to ankle plantar flexion. The correct answer to this question is 3. Weakness to great toe extension. So the patient described in the clinical scenario has a high-grade L5-S1 spondylolisthesis. Surgical reduction of this condition places the L5 nerve root at risk. Injury to the L5 nerve root can manifest as weakness to hip abduction, EHL, and tibialis anterior, which, remember, has a dual innervation with L4. Sensory manifestations would include pain or paresthesia over the lateral calf and dorsal foot. Chung et al. Reviewed spondylolysis and spondylolisthesis in adolescents. They recommend Insight 2 L5 to S1 posterolateral fusion for low-grade, that is, less than 50% slips that have failed non-surgical management. Although still controversial, they recommend Insight 2 L4 to S1 fusion for high-grade slips. Lonner et al. Addressed the pros and cons of surgical reduction for high-grade pediatric spondylolisthesis. In their review of 5 patients who underwent decompression and reduction, 2 had L5 nerve root deficits, which resolved within 3 months. Benefits of reductions included decrease in slip progression, restoration of sagittal balance, regional balance, and improved clinical outcomes. Petracco et al. Performed a cadaveric study to quantify the change in length of the L5 nerve root associated with reduction of spondylolisthesis. They found that the risk of stretch injury to the L5 nerve with reduction of a high-grade spondylolisthesis is not linear, with 71% of the total L5 nerve strain occurring during the second half of reduction. They inferred that partial reduction may be a significantly safer treatment approach for high-grade spondylolisthesis than complete reduction. Moving on to the next question. A 14-year-old boy is seen for back pain. Radiographic evaluation reveals a grade 3 ischemic spondylolisthesis. What measurement is most useful in predicting the likelihood of progression? And the choices are 1. Pelvic incidence, 2. Slip angle, 3. Sacral inclination, 4. Lumbosacral joint angle, and 5. Sagittal rotation. The correct answer to this question is 2. Slip angle. So slip angle has been shown to be highly predictive of the risk for increased slippage in patients with spondylolisthesis. None of the other radiographic parameters listed has been shown to be predictive of the risk for increased slippage. Moving on to the next question. A 17-year-old high school football lineman was diagnosed with a symptomatic spondylolysis without listhesis or neurologic deficits. He continues to have pain despite 6 months of wearing a custom lumbar spine orthotic or an LSO and avoiding all sports activities. His physical exam is notable for pain with single limb standing lumbar extension and a normal neurologic exam. How would the surgical management differ if this condition occurred at L3 instead of L5? And the choices are 1. Pars interarticularis repair is indicated. 2. Lumbosacral fusion is indicated. 3. The Gill procedure is indicated. 4. A combined anterior interbody fusion and posterior decompression is indicated. And 5. Iliac crest bone grafting is indicated. The correct answer to this question is 1. Pars interarticularis repair is indicated. So this clinical presentation is consistent with a symptomatic spondylolysis without listhesis or neurologic deficits that has failed non-operative management. Pain with single limb standing lumbar extension is a characteristic physical finding with this condition. The oblique radiograph demonstrates a defect in the pars interarticularis. The review article by Hu et al. Discusses surgical management of this condition. They argue that pars repair is feasible at L4 and above, while at L5 to S1, fusion with bone grafting is required. The Gill procedure, which is a wide and bilateral decompression of the neural elements with removal of the loose lamina, is only indicated when the patient has signs of the neural compromise. Combined anterior-posterior fusion approaches are only considered in patients with spondylolisthesis rather than those with spondylolysis alone. While some surgeons may prefer an initial attempt at pars repair for L5, the more established indication is at L4 and above. And the final question reads, what additional diagnostic test is most sensitive to diagnose pediatric spondylolysis when AP and lateral radiographs are normal? And the choices are 1, flexion extension lateral radiographs, 2, oblique radiographs of the lumbosacral spine, 3, a single photon emission computed tomography or SPECT scan, 4, indium-labeled bone scan, and 5, ultrasound. The correct answer to this question is 3, single photon emission computed tomography or SPECT. So of the listed answers, single photon emission computed tomography or SPECT is the most sensitive imaging modality to diagnose spondylolysis when AP and lateral radiographs are normal. Initial imaging studies should first include AP and lateral radiographs, which demonstrate 80% of defects, and oblique radiographs, which demonstrate an additional 15% of defects. If no lesion is seen on plain radiographs, SPECT can be considered as a diagnostic study. Conventional lumbar spine MRI techniques are valuable for demonstrating normality of the PARS, but may be associated with a high false positive rate for the diagnosis of PARS defects. That's all for this review of pediatric spondylolisthesis and spondylolysis. Hopefully that was helpful. This is the OrthoBullets podcast, a daily audio review session by OrthoBullets, the free learning and collaboration community for orthopedic surgery education. If you're enjoying the podcast so far, please consider leaving us a 5-star rating and writing us a review on Apple Podcasts. It will help us spread the word and increase our discoverability tremendously. Thanks so much, and we'll see you all tomorrow.